Hello and welcome to The Wire Weekly, the best stories of the week from some of the daily episodes of The Wire. I'm Roderick Chambers at 2SER FM in Sydney. Thanks so much for being with us today. We're on air across Australia thanks to the Community Radio Network and support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Coming up on The Wire Weekly today...
The $1.5 million units in council's modelling. I don't know who they help. They don't help any of the young people I know. They're not going to help me.
Council car parks will go to make way for up to 30,000 new Inner West homes in Sydney as the Inner West Council approved a controversial new housing plan. Also coming up on The Wire Weekly.
Sounds like a bad news story today, having pulled this stuff off the shelves. In some respects, it's a good news story because they found there's a problem and they've acted on it rather than a problem being missed.
Forced, recalled or under review following a debacle with SPF testing in a UK facility. Stay tuned for all of this and more coming up on The Wire Weekly. But first, Donald Trump says Hamas has 3 to 4 days to accept the 20-point peace plan he announced alongside Benjamin Netanyahu to achieve an immediate end to the war in Gaza. The plan demands Hamas hand over all of the remaining hostages and all of their weapons. Its short-term objectives also involve allowing humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip without interference. George Popel asked Dr. Anas Iktat, a senior lecturer at the Australian National University, if the vagueness of the plan's aims hinder its feasibility.
The plan is not meant to put a permanent end to the ongoing situation. Otherwise, the plan would have been put in a way that includes the wider Palestinian context. And I think that the vagueness is intentional. The vagueness is going to hinder the plan's implementation in the long run and will still keep Gaza contingent to the Israeli intentions.
Trump has claimed that there is not much room for negotiation and that if Hamas rejects the deal, Israel has the green light to finish the job. What alternatives are there for Hamas, and do you expect them to accept this deal?
One of the unique aspects of this proposal is that, one, it's the only proposal that has seen Israel accepting since January. And then two, which is the more important point, that the vast majority of Arab states, as well as many Islamic states such as Turkey and Pakistan and Indonesia, are backing the plan. So this really leaves very little room for Hamas to act. So it is widely expected that Hamas is going to agree to the plan. And this is precisely why, because it is being pushed by the regional as well as the Islamic bloc as well. Now, the Israeli government can also, in terms of finishing the job, there is very little ambiguity about Israeli plans here. So finishing the job is not necessarily moving to dismantle Hamas's infrastructure, let's say in Gaza and so on. It is the continuation of the current Israeli policy in Gaza City in particular, which has been demolishing the city one house at a time. And that has precisely what has been happening in the eastern suburbs and the northern suburbs. And this is what Israel means by finishing the job. And this is what Trump is also echoing when he uses this sort of terminology in describing the ongoing situation in Gaza.
Just last week, speaking to the UN General Assembly, Benjamin Netanyahu rejected the credibility of a Palestinian state. Yet this peace plan provides a pathway for Palestinian self-determination and statehood. How can you explain this quick turnaround from Netanyahu?
Very few analysts and observers of the Middle East are really looking at the plan as providing a pathway for Palestinians, for a Palestinian state. And this is certainly not the way that Netanyahu and the Israeli government are viewing the plan. And in many ways, the plan leaves the future of the Palestinians as a whole, and Palestine in particular, in limbo, really. It is vague on what it delivers. It is vague on the future of the Palestinian national movement. It is also vague on the future of Gaza as part of the wider Palestinian polity. So it may appear as if it is suggesting that there is a pathway for a day after towards a Palestinian state. But this is certainly not what the plan is being understood in Israel by the vast majority of analysts who are reading the plan within the wider context of Israel's policy towards the Palestinians. And this is part of what is weak in this plan, which is it is being intentionally, or it was written in an intentionally vague manner that opens it for interpretation by a wide array of different stakeholders.
In spite of the mention of Palestinian statehood and political control over Gaza, there is no mention of the West Bank in the plan. How does this affect the plan's long-term feasibility?
Yes, it undermines the plan. The Palestinians were not consulted about this plan. The Palestinians are being at the receiving end of this plan. And it's also the plan is making assumptions and decisions that will shape the future of the Palestinians, the future of the Palestinian political movement, and the future of Palestine itself. And therefore, it's a plan that really Hamas has no, let's say, say over accepting, particularly with regards to aspects that will define the future of Palestine as a whole.
Dr. Anas Iktat, senior lecturer from the Australian National University, speaking there with George Popel.
Hi, I'm Ray Martin. You're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio right across Australia. Stay well.
A team of international archaeologists have discovered over 60 rock art panels in Saudi Arabia. The engravings have been dated back to over 12,000 years and depict figures of life-sized animals. Maeve Groom asked Professor Michael Petralia, Director of the Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution at Griffith University, why this discovery is significant.
Well, we found more than 130 engravings as part of rock art of life-size animals. So people in the past, 12,000 years ago, were engraving camels and ibex and gazelles and aurochs into boulders in the middle of the desert. The site is really significant in that this is the first time that such engravings were ever found in Arabia in such abundance. And we've dated them to a period of time when the environment was very good. So there was plenty of rainfall and there were seasonal ponds. So there was potable water where these animals would be residing and hunted by the very people that were engraving them on the stone.
And in terms of this art being dated back to over 12,000 years old, what techniques were used to determine this age bracket?
If you can imagine, these images were engraved on standing boulders, but we excavated very systematically under a number of these boulders. We put in trench excavations that sometimes reach 2 meters in depth, and then we went about dating those layers. And we used two different techniques, radiocarbon dating and luminescence dating, to arrive at the age of 12,000 years ago when people were there and leaving behind their artifacts. They also left behind the pecked stones that were being used to engrave the images on the rock.
So the research suggests that this rock art marked water sources and movement routes. What does this tell us about the ancient travelers and human cultures living within this desert landscape?
People, once they moved into this landscape, when the environment was favorable for them to inhabit it, they started to engrave all of these images on the rock art. And we believe that they were marking territory so that other people, as they moved through the landscape, would see that people were already there. And these are highly mobile hunting and gathering societies. And so these images were marking that territory. But more than that, these images and engravings are quite spectacular. They are life-size and they are quite astounding, so very aesthetically pleasing. And we also believe that this had great importance to these people carving these images. So they were highly symbolic and probably conveyed a lot of meaning to them as well.
With the engravings depicting animals like camels, ibex, gazelles, is there a reason why these types of animals, do they reveal spiritual or cultural meaning?
If you think about the type of animals that were found, these are animals that are living in fairly marginal environments. So camels and ibex, for example, could live in marginal environments. So while there was seasonal ponds there and there would have been some grasslands, they're still in a fairly arid setting. So people are able to get into this area. They're able to subsist on these kinds of animals. And then they were portraying them probably in terms of symbolic acts on the boulders themselves.
Do discoveries like this change how we think about early migration routes throughout the Middle East and even in Australia, where we also have an arid desert climate in some parts of the country?
Our project really resonates in terms of thinking about climate change and what humans are able to do. So the period right before 12,000 years ago was a period when it was really hyper-arid and there was very little rainfall. So we have no evidence that people were actually there. But once the environment improved, we could see that hunter-gatherers moved in. But it wasn't until 6,000 years ago that the desert of Arabia formed again, and those hunting and gathering societies changed completely. Their economies changed, and then they started to domesticate the camel. In a place like Australia, certainly Aboriginal people were adapting to climate change through time, and they did that successfully for a very long period of time, up to 65,000 years.
Professor Michael Petrelia, Director of the Australian Research Centre for Human Evolution at Griffith University, speaking there with Maeve Groom.
Hey there, we're the Warren Miller Band and you're listening to The Wire on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
Sydney Inner West Council narrowly approved the Fairer Future Plan, which promises to build 20 to 30,000 new homes over the next 15 years in the locality. The plan also aims to increase social housing with the redevelopment of 5 council-owned car parks and incentivises churches and faith-based charities to redevelop their land. Marlena Holdenas asked Isabella Antonou, Greens Councillor for Ashfield, why she voted against the plan.
The main things that informed my decision were essentially affordability and community infrastructure. So my amendments were to ask for a full infrastructure plan as well as a developer contributions plan that could be considered side by side with this plan. Because if we're doing this much uplift and density, we need to make sure that we can actually deliver for current and future residents, making sure that our services, our infrastructure, cycleways, green space is actually going to be achievable so we can make sure we're retaining a quality of life, not just for current residents of the Inner West, but all our future neighbours as well. That is our duty.
Do you think that the community has been appropriately consulted?
There's multiple layers to the community consultation piece. When it comes to how people have felt and engaged with this process, there clearly has been gaps. Last August, we pushed for the second phase of the plan to also be put out on exhibition for longer than the 2 weeks that it was to enable people to properly look at how their changes and their feedback had been absorbed. Now, there's been a lot of pushback on the way that community has been consulted, but it's not just the way we consult with community. I think something we really need to talk to is the way that people's opinions and critiques of the plan have actually been engaged with, in many ways in quite bad faith. There's been this huge over-reliance on this dichotomy of the NIMBY-YIMBY, which I feel has actually made the debate worse. It has completely bulldozed, pardon the pun, over what people are trying to say, the details of the plan, and automatically putting people into these camps when realistically, most people want to see the Inner West grow sustainably with accessibility at the forefront and affordability, just with different ways of approaching that.
What was the atmosphere in the room when the plan passed last night?
It was mixed. I can definitely understand that there is excitement for new housing. I am a huge proponent that we do need new housing. However, I think there was a big split in the room down the middle because of the way that this debate has been completely framed. People are understandably upset that this plan has gone through in its current form. And realistically, there was no reason we could not take a little extra time to go back to the drawing board and actually make sure we were doing this right. Now, the idea that if we did that, it'd be stopping housing isn't correct at all. There are dwellings in the pipeline, thousands of them. So the idea that we have to do everything right now is a completely false way to approach it.
Sydney is famously the second most expensive city in the world to live in. Do you think now that it's been passed in its current form, the Fairer Future Plan will ease the housing crisis over the next 15 years?
I wish I could say yes. I wish it was that easy. Unfortunately, this plan focuses on supply, and yes, that is one of the levers council has, zoning that is, but nothing stops these dwellings being snapped up by investors, and they're going to rent it out as high as they can, and there's also this additional risk of us losing existing comparatively affordable homes, like, you know, those red brick apartments you see in the inner west, and share houses are now at risk because landlords are going to want to cash in and sell because now suddenly their land has been rezoned. The mayor actually explicitly said last night that this plan will not deflate the housing market, which, I'm going to be honest, I think we actually need that for broad scale affordability. The $1.5 million units in council's modelling, I don't know who they help. They don't help any of the young people I know. They're not going to help me. And I think that's the thing we need to keep bringing this back to. We also put some considerable advocacy pieces forward last night, asking to push back on the state and federal government to tackle things like negative gearing and capital gains, address Airbnb's swallowing up supply, which are very real mechanisms as to why housing is so expensive, not just in Sydney, but in Australia generally. And Labor voted that down. And that, to me, shows that this debate was never actually about genuine affordability.
Isabella Antonou, Inner West Greens councillor for the Ashfield-Jarrawong ward, speaking there with Marlena Holderness. The Therapeutic Goods Administration announced a list of sunscreens have been paused, recalled, or under its review. The TGA has expressed significant concerns with the reliability of SPF testing by a UK-based laboratory. Ruby Ward has this story.
The Therapeutic Goods Administration announced a list of sunscreens that have been paused, recalled, or are under its review after significant concerns over their SPF reliability. The 21 sunscreens sold by 17 companies share the same base formula made by manufacturer Wild Child Laboratories. The TGA said it had significant concerns about the reliability of SPF testing undertaken by Princeton Consumer Research Corp, a laboratory based in the UK. Professor of Chemistry Oliver Jones from RMIT University spoke on the standard globally accepted methods for SPF testing on humans and how they do work well.
What you essentially do is you take a set amount of sunscreen that you're testing and you apply it to the skin of volunteers that have come in for this, right? And you test and you basically time how long it takes for them to get for the skin to go red with and without the sunscreen. And then you look at the difference and you calculate the factor from the sun protection factor from that.
Right. And what are the limitations of that method?
You have to make sure you're doing it exactly the same each time. So you have to measure out exactly the right amount of sunscreen. You have to be using a particular type of lamp. It also depends a little bit on the volunteers that you have. So, for example, if you've used no sunscreen at all, different people's skin reacts differently to sun. So you need to make sure that you're testing a variety of skin types and then sort of taking that into account when you're calculating your SPF factor. So it doesn't sound like it's as scientific as you might expect, but that's currently the sort of best practice. For the most part, it works pretty well.
Oliver Jones says the recent recalls of multiple sunscreen brands could be a good thing.
To be honest, all the ones that are on the market in Australia are tested, and when something happens, it is picked up. So although it sounds like a bad news story today, having pulled this stuff off the shelves, in some respects it's a good news story because they found there's a problem and they've acted on it rather than a problem being missed.
Director of Sir Ian Porter Nanobiosensing Facility at RMIT University, Professor Vipul Bansal, stated there are significant ethical concerns on current SPF testing as it requires human subjects to be exposed to unnecessary UV radiation.
So as a part of SPF testing, those tests need to be performed on humans. They call in vivo tests. So in that case, a sunscreen product is applied on the human skin, and then the ultraviolet light, UV light, is shine upon the skin. And then it is observed how long it takes for the reddening of the skin to occur. So in that context, we are exposing the participants to a UV irradiation, which is a class 3 carcinogen. So there are ethical concerns around using in vivo methods on human skin for SPF testing.
Professor Bansal explained how variability in test subjects might affect results as they are subject to interpretation.
So there are variabilities in current methods because subject to interpretation, as you rightly said. But also those variations should not be to the extreme level. What we found, what we saw in the choice reports, and some of those products were retested. now TGS come back and some of these products are taken off the market. So we do expect some level of variability, but not to an extent where SPF 60 was reported or 50 plus was reported. Now it's coming to SPF 4. So there have been some issues with the testing bodies as well, some of these testing agencies. And yes, there's inherent variability in the in vivo testing method.
So how do we know which sunscreen to buy? I asked Professor Bunsell, what would you recommend to look out for to make sure the one you're buying is reliable?
Out of choice reports, there were a few products that came out as originally claimed. So while TGA is investigating the other products, I think we might safely use those products at the moment, while I'm not advocating one brand over other. And at the end of the day, sunscreen is only one of the five different ways of protecting ourselves against the UV radiation. So we should wear, protective clothing and all. And we should still use sunscreen because it provides an additional level of protection. And when we talk about different SPF values, there's small differences in the amount of UV it blocks, really. So even if the SPF values are slightly lower than originally claimed, I think it's still worth applying the sunscreens.
Professor Vipul Bunsai, founding director of the Sir Ian Potter Nanobiosensing Facility, speaking there with Ruby Ward.
Hey there, I'm Hamish McDonald. Around Australia, you're listening to The Wire. Take it easy.
Growing up in Australia, you speak English every day, but perhaps another language alongside it, something you picked up at home or through family. But later in life, if dementia sets in, that second language might fade. You can find yourself slipping back into the way you first learned to speak as a child, returning to the rhythms and words of your earliest language. Thomas Kutis asked Dr. Fahud Hanna, Associate Professor in Public Health at Torrens University, how language loss due to dementia might affect a migrant's sense of identity and belonging.
Obviously, as you know, that dementia impacts areas of the brain that is responsible for thinking, for memory, or even things like everyday function. So the condition can lead to multiple issues and health issues, including the way you think and the way you talk and the way you remember things. So one of the things that happen is that language that is acquired later on in life, and I mean after your very first language, which was learned during infancy and childhood, so that language is pretty much well protected. But the languages that were learned afterwards and acquired afterwards, such as what happens when you migrate to another country and you adopt a new language to survive, obviously, is actually impacted quite heavily. Yep. What happens is a bit of stripping of that sort of second language, if you like.
What unique challenges do culturally and linguistically diverse families face when navigating dementia care systems, which can be very difficult, right?
Well, it's very difficult to navigate anything in terms of health issues for those who are culturally and linguistically diverse due to barriers, cultural barriers, language barriers, ethnic barriers, in some cases religious barriers, and the understanding of health and disease is different from culture to culture. And in Australia, we have melting pot of so many different cultures, and that's all beautiful. And integration and coming together as one nation is a fantastic concept in today's terms. But when you think about the challenges that also imposes on healthcare system, on families, on carers, access, we talk a lot about access and the equity in that sense. A lot of multicultural or ethnic groups struggle with access, but the problem is due to cultural barriers, access becomes a little bit of a mystery because understanding and being aware of what the access is and how you can access services and interpret the services and so on and so forth.
How does the loss of a second language impact communication between the patients, the caregivers, and even the healthcare professionals?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and it's the core of this issue, I guess. Carers and healthcare providers and clinicians would speak English, place like Australia, so they prefer communicating in English. However, we do have interpreter services here and there. They can reduce that sort of problem, if you like. The problem with dementia is that the stripping of the second language takes the individuals back to their childhood language, and sometimes to very basic mother tongue, if you like, that is almost impossible for the interpreters themselves to actually understand. And that's when you have a breakdown of communication that is related to what we call diagnosis and assessment and so on and so forth, and also what is really required for this particular individual compared to another individual, which is obviously, as you know, when it comes to healthcare, there needs to be always tailored treatment and tailored management, you know, based on the individual and their needs. So not actually really understanding the language that is now being surfacing in the dementia patient becomes a massive obstacle in trying to properly assess and or tailor, if you like, or design that management.
Going to go back to the part about healthcare providers. Is that where they need to sort of step in and create programs to help people with dementia who are migrants?
Well, of course. The point here is healthcare providers and policymakers, if you like, in this space, in dementia care, will need to be fully aware of what dementia is doing to culturally diverse or culturally and linguistically challenged, if you like, individuals. So having that in mind and incorporate that in the design of intervention, using properly trained interpreters who can actually provide good feedback to healthcare providers to then work on interventions and treatments, but also more importantly on policies and guidelines for treating dementia.
Dr. Fahad Hanna, Associate Professor in Public Health at Torrens University, speaking there with Thomas Kutis. And that's it for us on The Wire Weekly this week, but we're going to be back again next week, and of course The Wire will be broadcast each weekday as well. The Wire Weekly is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER 107.3 in Sydney, in the country of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is broadcast nationwide on the Community Radio Network with the support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I'm Roderick Chambers. It's been great to be with you. Stay well. We'll be right back.